Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi. James Begley was interstate, so I've got this interview solo. And I sat down with Nadal Rashid, entrepreneur and founder of Silvertail Property Group. It has been quite a journey for Nadal, whose business career began as a teenager with network marketing and lolly vending machines. Selling sugary treats was so profitable it helped him pay his way through uni. But it was Nadal's move into the restaurant game that became a baptism of fire. The 22-year-old was struggling to manage staff, trying to do it all, and then found himself in hospital due to stress. At that point, he was sent overseas by his parents to find himself. He came back with a renewed focus and drive, throwing himself into property sales, paying off his restaurant debts, and quickly becoming the most successful salesman at his company nationally. It could have been easy to enjoy the fruits, but the passion for business was still there. He quit and started Silvertail Property Group from his kitchen table, with zero clients and a simple plan to help property investors with their projects from start to finish. Within a couple of years, Silvertail had helped hundreds of clients and had grown to become a national award-winning company. Nadal shares his story as well as business lessons and wealth-building advice. Enjoy our chat. Nadal, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Now, what goes through your mind these days when you walk past a lolly vending machine?
A bit of nostalgia. I always think back to my early childhood days. Actually, funny story, when I was at school, I think probably started around year 7, year 8. I was about 12, 13 years old. I actually used to buy little warheads, those little sour lollies, and I used to buy them in bulk and I used to sell them to my friends individually. So I quickly worked out that it was a good way to make a profit, and I had a passion for, you know, buying and selling things and turning over a little profit along the way. And from there, years later, I had read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and right at the very end, I learned that, you know, you need to buy assets that produce money for you while you sleep. And I thought, what better way to do it than through a lolly vending machine? So I worked the summer holiday, saved up all my money, and then went and bought 6 lolly machines at the time and put them out at, you know, family and friends, cafes, you know, snack bars, pizza shops. Mm. I had them at car dealers, at mechanics. And it was a really good, you know, money-making venture for me while I was, you know, still at school and into uni. So I was always a kid with rattling change in his pocket, basically.
That's awesome. So how do you go and acquire a lolly vending machine? How much do they cost?
Well, at the time, I bought 6 of them for $2,000. So that was a really good deal because the guy that was selling them wanted to see a young kid succeed, basically. Yeah. He was asking for a lot more, but basically all I had was $2,000, and I negotiated with him and I told him my story and what I was trying to do. And I guess he wanted to support me and wanted to see a little kid actually make something out of it. And yeah, he gave me a really good deal on him. After I'd bought the 6 lolly machines and I'd put them out, I think at one point I was making roughly about $1,200 a month for myself. So it didn't take long to recoup my investment back. And then everything over and above that was profit for me from there on.
That's brilliant. And how old are you at the time?
At the time, I was about 14 years old. So this is after working my first summer holiday with my dad. He's a glazier, so I used to go out with him and work. And, you know, I'd probably get like, you know, $50 for working the whole day with him. So after saving that money for a summer's worth of work, that was my first investment and that was my first business.
What an amazing kind of way to learn, like in terms of a practical way to learn business skills.
Yeah, it was a very cool business to run because I used to love lollies as well. So I don't know whether I made profit because I was spending a lot on stock.
Don't they say don't get high off your own supply or something like that?
Exactly right. So I had to learn that lesson pretty quickly too.
Yeah, so. Very good. And what else? Now, you're obviously buying and selling. You had a bit of a passion for it at a young age. Were you in any other kind of little businesses as a youngster?
I was. I think one of my turning points in the early days was actually being around network marketing businesses. So when I was 14 years old, I saw my parents and some family and friends get involved with a network marketing company that sold websites back then. And it was through that network that I got exposed to Rich Dad, Poor Dad, through, you know, other business books as well. And it was those lessons that I learned along the way that allowed me to think about business and think about life in a different way. Mm. And it was those lessons that then made me think, okay, I need a money-making asset. I need to be able to generate money while I sleep, and I need to be able to do that through either a business or an investment. Mm. So my mindset was instantly molded to start thinking about how am I going to be making money that I don't have to necessarily sell my time for. So that's where it all started. And over the years, I got involved in a lot of ventures. So I did get involved in network marketing at the time. I did make some money along the way, but what I learned along the way was probably more valuable than the money that I made, because it was those lessons that I took with me into my career and into business. And I can genuinely say that those lessons is what's contributed to some of the success.
I mean, people have differing views about network marketing, but one thing's for sure, you would learn a heck of a lot about sales.
Absolutely.
And sales is, I kind of view it almost like oxygen in terms of the importance. Like everyone needs to.
That's what makes the world go round.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's... And, you know, when you're first learning as well and you're first working, it's not about working. It's not work to earn. It's about working to learn. Mm. So for me, I just wanted to sponge it all up. And some of the lessons that you learn by working or being exposed to some of these network marketing companies are invaluable. So there's some really good value that you can get out of them. So me personally, I don't do any network marketing these days, but I'm a big fan of the business model and what it does for people who are looking for opportunities to go out there and make something for themselves.
So as a youngster, you're working, probably a couple of jobs, and instead of mucking around playing video games, it seems like you're out there pounding the pavement and selling. What was that like as a youngster? Did you kind of feel like you were missing out, or did you just had the drive back then?
Not really. I was never into video games. I was always the odd kid. I was never the one that was doing what all the other kids were doing. So when my mates were playing video games, I'd probably be on a computer researching, you know, a money-making venture or a business opportunity or of some sort. You know, when everyone was out partying, I'd be, you know, sitting there packaging up my little samples of whatever I was selling at the time. So the lessons that I learned along the way were, you know, massive, and they were invaluable. Biggest thing I learned was that people want to see you succeed. You know, if you are a good person, you want to do the right thing and you do good, it comes back to you, and it comes back to you in forms that you can't imagine. So when I first started, I just went out to my family and friends and my network, and, you know, some of the stuff that I was selling at the time, people didn't need it, but they still bought it off me just to support me, because they wanted to see me succeed, and they wanted to see the little kid, you know, go out there and actually, you know, succeed at what I was doing. So that taught me a lesson that people want to see you succeed. And that expectation instantly gets rid of the fear of failure, gets rid of the fear of being judged, gets rid of all these fears that people have placed upon them that holds people back from going out there and taking a, you know, a punt at something. So that was probably one of the key lessons. The other lesson was that you have to go out there and be persistent, and you can't give up too quickly, because even though there are some people that want to see you succeed, on the same token, there's a lot of people out there, you know, waiting for you to fail as well. Mm. So that gives you a different type of motivation to go out there and even work harder to make sure that, you know, you achieve what you set out to, because you don't want them to see you fail and, you know, for them to, for them to sort of confirm that, you shouldn't have done this or whatever it may be.
Yeah. No. So you've working these multiple kind of jobs, little businesses, you got your qualification, you were studying as well?
Yeah, I was doing my marketing degree at UniSA. Yeah. And whilst I was at uni, I wasn't sold on the education system and, you know, having a degree at the end of it, because I just knew, you know, that you didn't have to be a uni graduate to be successful in life. And that was, you know, probably some of the key takeouts I got from Rich Dad Poor Dad at the time, was that, you know, some of the most successful people in the world don't necessarily have degrees, but my cultural background was conditioned me to believe that, no, I had to go to your school, had to go to uni, get the degree, and then go get a job.
Was that kind of driven from family?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I was wanting to rebel against that, and I wanted to go against the grain. So I purposely didn't, you know, do well at school sometimes or at uni, because I knew that I was going to be successful, but I knew that I wasn't going to be relying on the uni degree to kind of give me that success. So whilst I was at uni, I had a few different ventures. Right at the very end, I had decided to get into business, and I bought into my first proper bricks and mortar business, so to speak. So I had a restaurant on Henley Beach Road, and needless to say, that probably taught me more than, you know, 10 uni degrees could. So
tell us, I mean, you've already kind of unpacked the various different industries that you've had a bit of a crack at. Why were you interested in restaurants?
At the time, I was working as a marketing consultant or marketing manager for a family, you know, family member who had multiple cafes, and I was the person that was just doing, you know, some campaigns, emailing, doing, you know, flyers, things like that. And as a result, we ended up getting into a partnership and buying a restaurant together. And I never thought I would ever get into the hospitality industry. I've never, you know, my family didn't have anything to do with hospitality. I had never worked in a restaurant or a cafe or anything. I didn't know the first thing about running a restaurant, but I was thrown into I had an opportunity present itself, and I just knew, look, you got to throw yourself at it and figure it out along the way. And as a result, I, you know, had to find ways to make it work. And initially it was a massive struggle. I didn't know what I was doing. I was only 22 years old at the time, and I had staff that were twice my age. And back then I found it uncomfortable to tell someone that was older than me what to do. It was, you know, call it cultural belief or whatever it was, but there was something there that held me back from being able to direct, you know, people, because I thought, you know, you have to respect your elders. And it was a massive learning curve for me, because I had to dig deep and find more within myself to be able to make it work.
So were you in there involved in the day-to-day?
Absolutely. Everything from, you know, being in the kitchen to being on the floor to running the show to cleaning the toilets to emptying everything. So at one point I was working 7 days a week, and I was going from 7, 8 in the morning right through till midnight every day. I'd lost a lot of weight and I started to physically weaken, and it got to a point where I got sick out of it. On a number of occasions, I end up in a hospital bed, and got to a point where the doctor said, you're under an immense amount of stress and you've got to do something about it. And when my parents found out that was the case, they freaked out and they kicked up a big fuss, and they wanted me to close the restaurant, and I couldn't, you know, give up on that business that I'd started. It was everything for me at the time. But they forced me to take a holiday. They sent me overseas. They told me to go to one of my best friend's wedding at the time. And my mum, I remember her saying, go change your life and come back. Go decide on what you want to do for the rest of your life and come back. And we don't want to hear restaurant in there. So, it was a confronting situation for me at the time, because I thought, you know, I had to make this restaurant work. I had to.
Yeah, there's a lot of pride there.
Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you first get into business, you know, there's a big expectation that, you know, you on yourself that you'll succeed and you'll make money and all that. But it wasn't the case for me at the time. I was going backwards financially, emotionally, in every way. I was actually deteriorating, and I couldn't see it for myself. It took someone to point it out to me. But when they did, it was probably the best thing that happened to me.
It's an interesting one, because it's kind of like almost most business owners would face that situation where you decide to either push through it or giving up is a bad term for it, I think. But because you do see a lot of people who will push through the kind of pain barrier and those tough points and actually do something really successful. So it's that interesting one, isn't it, trying to weigh that up.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure when your health is deteriorating and you having some of those, you know, the emotional impacts, that's probably when you start thinking,
absolutely,
maybe this isn't the right thing for me.
I'm a genuine believer that everything happens for a reason. I know it sounds cliche and everything, but sometimes if it's not meant for you, it's not meant for you, and, you know, and things won't go smoothly for you, and, you know, challenges and things like that will come up. So by going through the restaurant experience, it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me, looking back at it. And that's what shaped me to then go into business with a different outlook, and, you know, and it taught me the value of hard work and everything. But at the time, I wouldn't say it was giving up. It was basically a change of strategy for me, because I wasn't tied into the restaurant or the hospitality industry, but I knew that strategy or that vehicle was not not going to get me to where I was. So it was kind of like, there's no point running east looking for a sunset, you know? So you had to, I had to change strategy along the way.
So you went overseas and reflected and...
Yeah, I got to go overseas and get myself out of the environment and start thinking straight. I went, saw my family, I saw my best friend get married, and it really put life in perspective for me because I got to see how people on the other side were living. I saw the problems that they were having, the challenges that they were facing, and all of a sudden...
What country were you in?
I went to Lebanon.
Okay, yeah.
And I went, and it put things in perspective because when you see a child begging on the street... You know, your problem of not having enough to pay wages at the end of the week isn't such a bad problem. Mm. You know, when you see people living and sleeping under a bridge, it, you know, your problems that you have here aren't so big. So it really did give me contrast of what real challenges looked like for some people, put things in perspective. And as a result, I came back and I was grateful for everything that was going on, good or bad. And it was that gratitude that then started to fuel and feed all the other elements of my life that then pushed me in the right direction thereafter.
So you turned your attention to property?
Yeah. So whilst I was overseas, I really got some time to think to myself, and I kept reflecting back on what was it that I wanted to be when I was a kid. And I'm a big believer, if you go back to and search, so what is it that drove you as a child? You know, when you had no barriers, when you had no limitations on your thinking, when you had no outside influences, what was it that you wanted to do? And for me, I remember used to playing with Legos. I used to love being on construction sites with my dad. I used to love seeing buildings come up. I used to love, you know, anything to do with properties. Even from a very young age, my first word was key. And, you know, my grandma's friends used to say that in my past life, I used to be a property developer. And, you know, that all of these things started to come together. And I thought, well, property's what I really want to be doing when I'm older. It's the thing that I'm going to be doing, you know, for the rest of my life. I'm always going to be involved with it in some way, shape or form. So why don't I turn my passion into my business? And came back and I thought, okay, well, what's the best way to get into the industry? I didn't have a lot of money. I was, you know, at a point where I was financially, you know, nearly gone. And I had to get into the industry in a way that didn't require an upfront investment, because property is a big ticket item, and to become a developer or to buy properties, you need a lot of money, and I didn't have that. So I decided to work as a consultant initially to learn the industry and everything. So I went and got licensed. So I started studying and getting qualified. And then I got a job with a developer and a national developer, and they had a base here in Adelaide. So I worked for Divine Homes at the time. And
Did you have kind of the hangover from the restaurant in terms of debts and other things that you had to work through as well?
Absolutely. So I was at a turning point in my life at the stage where I was exiting the restaurant, because that's when I met my life partner at the time. And as a result of meeting her, I then had to start thinking about starting a family, building a house, getting married, and, you know, and all of that takes a lot of money these days. So it's not cheap and it's not free. So I had to then fulfill my previous commitments and any debts that I had as a result of the restaurant. So needless to say, I was working around the clock. And because I'd come out of the restaurant where I was working, you know, 14, 15, 16 hour days, and all of a sudden into an office environment where, you know, everyone, the expectation was you only work 7.5 hours, I was working double what I would have, because I knew that I had to get the results. I had no option of not succeeding. So my only option was I had to succeed, and I had to, you know, do what I set out to do. Otherwise, I was going to be in a lot of trouble. And as a result of that pressure being on me, I made some decisions that didn't allow me to get bogged down with the day-to-day stuff that most people get bogged down in. Mm. I started in the industry at the worst time. And I look back at it now. I started November 2011. And November 2011 was actually the bottom of the market in South Australia. And I remember starting at the company and, you know, some of the senior guys were saying, oh, this is the worst time of the year. You know, after pageant, no one buys property. No one makes sales in December.
Pageant impact property.
Apparently so. So I didn't listen to it. I just knew that, look, if I wanted to be successful, I just had to keep myself out of the office talk, like the water cooler talk. And I just had to focus on just doing what was needed to achieve the results. So I told my sales manager at the time, I said, look, just give me names and numbers of people who've inquired but haven't actually bought, and let me make something of it. So that was given something like 300 names and numbers on the database of people that had inquired in the last 5 years. And all I did is just called every client up and gave them a customer care call, you know, if I found out, you know, what their experience was and, you know, tried to figure out if I could help them in any way. And, you know, 95% of the people said, no, we're all right and we've moved on. But then 5% of the people still were in the market. And as a result of those, I booked in my first few appointments and I made 2 sales at a time where no one in the office had made anything. And I backed it up the following year. So we came back from Christmas holidays and I hit the ground running. And within that first year, I was the number one consultant in SA for the company. And then within the second year, I was number one in the country and just maintained that, that status.
How critical were those early sales in terms of building confidence, given where you'd come from?
That was the foundation, you know, for what was about to come. And I didn't know what I didn't know. And sometimes I think they say ignorance is bliss, and it was for me because I didn't know what the limitations were. I didn't know what the cap was. I didn't know what the maximum was. So for me, I had my confidence knocked around because I just left a business that I was, you know, owner in. And, you know, some people may have looked at it as a step down, but, you know, a friend of mine put it in perspective. She said to me, it's like a rubber band when you, you know, stretch it backwards and then you let go, you propel a lot. You know, a lot further.
You did well to not carry baggage into this next stage.
Absolutely. You have to emotionally detach from a lot of things that happen in life. I believe, you know, stressing and worrying is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do but doesn't take you anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I had to acknowledge the fact that, yes, I had been through what I'd been through and I had to let go of a lot of it and accept it and take the lessons out of it, because I think when you accept something that's happened in your life and you can accept the lesson out of it, that's when you can mentally, emotionally and physically move on. Until you've accepted it and taken the responsibility for what's happened and learned the lesson and seen how it's going to make you better and how it's going to propel you forward, I think you're always going to get caught up in thinking about it and overthinking about it. So for me, it was just really about mentally and emotionally detaching from what had happened and moving on, because I had no another option.
So you've found success in property sales. I think it's well known that people selling property, if you're doing well, you do very well.
Absolutely.
But you still decided to then go back to pursuing your own business.
Yeah.
Why?
Whilst I was at the company where I was working, I always had the entrepreneurial flair about me. So I always wanted to do more than what was a norm. And many a times I'd go to my managers and I'd say, look, can I start a team? Can we do this differently? Can we try this kind of campaign? Can we get some guys in to do some calling? And then I'd try different strategies. And then the idea would go up, you know, 3, 4, 5 levels and then come back down, saying, you know, this is the way we do things here. A few times I'd ask for promotions because I started to get bored. I told them I can do more than just be a consultant. I've got business experience. I've, you know, done a few things that I think I could add value to. And the same story would happen. It would go up a few levels and then come back down with, look, you know, this is how we do things here. And in the end, it was an itch inside of me. That coupled with a few experiences that I had, particularly, you know, when I'm in a face-to-face environment where I see clients not getting the right service or not being told the right thing or getting stung, because building and construction can be quite tricky. And if you don't know what you're doing or if you don't know what to look for, it, you know, one simple mistake could result in tens of thousands of dollars in extra costs. So I'd see this on a weekly basis and I'd do my absolute best to try and get people to stay away from certain companies or from certain ways of building. I'd make sure that I'd just vet their contracts for them. And sometimes I say, look, even if you didn't deal with me, just let me give you some advice on what to do, just so that way you don't end up in that same position that this other person did. Because you'd see a lot when you're in the industry. And I wanted to do something about it on a way I could influence it and, you know, control it. So I decided that I wanted to start a business where I would offer a consulting service for people who wanted to go out and invest in property. And the whole thing would be about helping them find the property, helping them set up the right finance structures, put them in touch with the right people, you know, project manage the thing for them, but make sure they got a fixed price contract, made sure that they got a turnkey build, made sure that, you know, they didn't make the mistakes that a lot of other people had made along the way. And I genuinely believe that if I provided that kind of value, that I was going to be rewarded in direct proportion to it. So this
became Silvertail.
And that's where Silvertail was born. So this is probably close to 3 years now where I started mapping it all out. And at the time I was doing a bit of flying around, going to personal development seminars. And whilst I'd be on airplanes, I'd have just blank A4 sheets of paper and I'd be sitting there drawing out what my logos were going to look like, the business model, the hierarchies, the marketing strategy, the business strategy, sales strategy, everything. And over a period of a couple of months, I had a business, you know, that was in my head now on paper. And I wanted to, you know, take it to the next level. And I was always worried that, you know, I got to a point where I was very comfortable at work. And, you know, when you're financially comfortable, it's a dangerous place to be because you're not stretching yourself, you're not challenging yourself, you're not doing anything outside of the comfort. And I knew that I had to do something about it. It was kind of like it was my responsibility to take it to the next level. And when I did, I decided to, you know, to resign from where I was, and I took my manager out for a drink. And I broke the news to him and I told him, look, I'll give him, you know, 3, 4, 5 months to sort of get someone else on board, and I'd help him train him up and make sure that I didn't have a negative impact on the business. And they were, you know, supportive of that. But the day that I resigned, so the day that I handed in my resignation, my partner tells me that she was pregnant with our first child. So then that was a sign for me. That was a positive sign that, okay, yep, this is what I'm meant to be doing, and this is my fuel, because I knew the fire was there. I had that burning desire to go out there and make it work, but to ensure that I was going to make it work, I had to provide for a family.
Some people would default into safety net mode though.
And that was a question that came up every single, you know, hour of the day, is that have I made the right decision? You know, and in the midst of this, I had some of the managers flying down from head office and trying to make me offers to keep me there. And they were putting some very attractive numbers in front of me as well.
How tempted were you?
Look, the money side of it was tempting, but I knew that it wasn't going to give me the satisfaction of what I would if I'd created something. And, you know, once you've made that decision mentally and you're emotionally invested into it, and that's it, the decision's made, and in your mind it's already started to come to fruition. I had to keep pushing back and you know, declining. But it was very tempting. It was very tempting.
So you start the business, I assume, with zero clients?
Absolutely, with nothing.
Where are you working from?
I started in the garage. So the typical garage story, I had a home office at the time, but because I started to get some friends involved and two of them ended up working for me, I'd hold our sales meetings and our company meetings in the garage every Tuesday night after work. So we would get together around 7:30, 8 o'clock every Tuesday night. I'd have the whiteboard out and I'd sit there and start mapping out what the business was going to look like, what our selling propositions were, what our value propositions was, who our clients were, how we're going to find them, how we're going to, you know, position ourselves in the market. And I would do that every single week with a few of my friends. And as I mentioned, you know, a few of them went on to start working with me as well.
So do you remember your first client and what it was like when you won them?
Absolutely, absolutely. So my first client was actually my next door neighbor. And I didn't have a very close relationship with them at the time, but I'd started the business. So I was working from home. And my first week working from home was actually a very confronting experience for me because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know, you know, how am I supposed to schedule my day? Now I'm responsible for my day. Do I, you know, can I give myself time off? Do I just work harder? And because I was, you know, going my hardest at the time, I'd be working from, you know, the time I woke up to the time I slept. And one day my wife wanted me to do some gardening outside, and I don't do gardening. I don't do physical work, but I was outside and my neighbor knew that I used to work at Divine Homes. Came up and asked me, you know, for some advice. They were looking at buying their first home. So I gave him some advice on what to look for, what not to look for, et cetera. And I said, look, you know, I could actually help you with finding a property if you like. And I ended up finding the perfect property for them that was, you know, within their budget for their family, next to the schools they wanted, et cetera. And that was probably the most exhilarating experience that I've had in my business, you know, getting that first client on board and doing that first, you know, sign up, and, you know, everything was happening for the first time, and I was scrambling around trying to, you know, get my processes together and I was a one-man band at the time. So I was the one doing the selling and the admin and the contracts and, you know, the running around and all of that. And it was, you know, looking back at it, it was probably one of the most fun times that I had because everything was brand new and I knew that this was my client. It wasn't someone else, it was my client, you know. I was so proud of that. It's actually reflecting back on it now, it actually gives me that same feeling that I felt back then.
That's awesome. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the model works? You spoke a bit about it in terms of when you're at the planning stage, but kind of from go to woe for a new client, how do you guys actually work?
Yeah, we've got a system that we've come up with and it's called Hello to Handover. So from the time we say hello to the time they get handed over their property, we take care of every moving part that's in between those two stages. So the business is set up as a buying agency for people who want to invest in property. So the idea was if someone wants to invest in property but doesn't know where to go, where to start, who to talk to, or how to put a deal together or how to make it happen, they would generally come to us. We would work out, you know, where they are right now, work out what their end goal is and what they're trying to achieve out of investing, you know, whether we want to go for growth or for yield or, you know, to generate equity or manufacture equity, so to speak. And once we've got a plan or a strategy in place, we will then go out and help find the property. We'll then organize all the financing. So we're working with, you know, a broker to get the money side of it happening. We do all the contract and the paperwork side of it. So we vet the contracts to make sure they're fixed price turnkey properties. We, you know, put them in touch with the right conveyancers or lawyers or solicitors along the way. We'll project manage the build. So if it's a brand new construction, everything from settling on the land to starting the construction to managing that whole process, we look after. You know, even down to getting the insurances for them at the end, finding a tenant, putting them in touch with the right property manager, that's depending on the area that they're buying into, and then looking after the ongoing portfolio review. So once someone has invested in a property, every year we'll sit down with them and go through a portfolio review to work out how much growth they're getting from their properties and how much of that equity we can utilize to invest in the next one. And the whole plan is to help people build a portfolio and create prosperity through property, because my belief is property is one of the best vehicles for people to create wealth. In fact, 9 out of every 10 millionaires has generated their wealth through property investing. And for us, part of the overall mission and what we were trying to create is help people take advantage of that vehicle, because a lot of people don't know what they don't know. They are relying on the pension or on superannuation or on something outside of them to then fund their retirement and support them in the later years. But we've all seen how that's turned out in recent times, particularly with the global financial crisis. You know, that was a wake-up call for a lot of people. So a lot of people have now decided to take matters into their own hands and go out there and look after their own investments and their own retirement plan. And as a result, we've started to scratch the surface on a really nice niche in the market of people who want to do it, but they just need a little bit of guidance or some assistance or someone just to do the work for them, basically. They know what they want, but they just want that person to go out there and make it happen.
You mentioned winning your first client.
Yep.
Where did the early growth come from?
Initially, I was working like a madman trying to build relationships with other businesses that I could complement. So I knew right from the word go, I didn't want to build the train track from scratch. I wanted to try and find an existing train and I wanted to attach my carriage onto the back of that. So what that meant is I wanted to go find other businesses that I could complement and add a layer of service to their business that they couldn't offer and that would make them look good in front of their clients, but in turn, give me the benefit of building my business. So what I did is I worked out my value proposition was really, you know, was best suited to accountants, finance brokers, financial planners, and people in that industry, because they're constantly working with clients who want to buy property or who need to invest in property because they might have tax problems, or they are wanting to invest but they're time poor. So I knew that they were dealing with the clients that I wanted to work with. So what I did is I, you know, put together a value proposition and I went out and I would even cold call on them. I would prospect through LinkedIn, through Facebook, and I was just networking like a madman at the time, knowing that, you know, one of them had to sort of see the value in it and it would work. So one of the first accountants that I actually came across is now a business partner. And it started off, I put a Facebook status out asking my friends and family to tag their accountants. And I would call every one of them. And one of them who I called was Joe Mastrantoni from GM Tax and Accounting. And I cold called him and I basically introduced myself. One of my uni friends had tagged him and we started talking and I told him what I was doing as a business and he said, all right, come see me Friday, 11 o'clock. So Friday, 11 o'clock came around. I went and I saw Joe and I was just this young kid. Like I was just a young guy that was just full of energy, full of enthusiasm. And I just wanted to make something happen with him. I had no marketing material. I had no collateral. I had no nothing at the time. I hadn't even launched the business back then. So me and Joe got talking and he saw some potential in me, but initially didn't start referring business straight away. A few months went by and I kept, you know, maintaining that relationship and going back and, you know, trying different angles and different ways to reconnect. And then one day after I had launched and I was sitting in my home office, I get an email with just a name and a number. And I thought, okay, my first opportunity. So I spoke with the client, went over to their house and saw them, worked, you know, made sure that they were happy with everything. And I over-serviced them to the point where the client went back to the accountant and said, well, thank you for recommending us to Nadal. You know, he's been brilliant. He's just followed up. He's done everything right. And, you know, we're thankful that you put us in touch with him. So once he got that feedback, he sent me another client. He sent me another harder one. Did the same thing, over-surfaced them and just made sure that they were really happy with it. And then they went back and did it and got to a point where he thought, okay, well, this guy's actually doing the right thing by my clients. He's making me look good in front of them. He's doing everything he said he was going to do. And then before I knew it, I was getting, an influx of referrals from him. So I remember 1 month I got something like 10 referrals and that's unheard of, you know, in our industry, because that's a lot of business, especially when you're in your first, you know, month or two in and you're starting up.
You're still a one-man band.
I was still a one-man band. So what I do is
you describe the process. It's not like it's an easy job to turn over.
There's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
There's a whole heap of work that needs to be done. So we worked out it takes about 160 hours worth of work from hello to handover, you know, by the time you do all the follow-ups and everything like that. So there was there was a big opportunity for it. And I remember when I first started, I'd just go to Joe's office and he'd see a client and I'd be there just to sort of sit in with the appointment with him. And, just did that when I first started. And it was probably the best thing that I could have done at the time to get started and to launch, because all those initial clients that I started working with is what helped me take the business to the next level and actually start hiring some staff and getting a business premises and taking things to that next level, basically. And then after some time of doing this, and it was a really good relationship, I asked Joe whether he'd be interested to come on as a partner and be a consultant to the business and give me some guidance. He's been doing this for 20 years. He wanted to make sure that he was getting into business with the right person. So he's very traditional in his ways as well. So the families went out for dinner and, you know, we got to know each other on different levels. And yeah, by the time we were ready to execute the deal, we had a really good foundation in place and we've become, you know, great mates since.
Were there any hard bits?
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you can have a business without going through some hard times. The challenges that I have with Silvertel, or had with Silvertel at the time, was the time it was taking for a client to go through, because there's a latency with how things work. So I might see a client right now, but I might not, get any financial reward out of that for 6 to 9 months, sometimes even over a year. Correct. Yeah. So cash flow was a big challenge for us. So having an accountant in the business was handy, because he would, you know, address my concerns and would put strategies in place to overcome that. And, there's no challenge that you can't overcome.
What would your tips be? There are a lot of businesses that do have that long tail type of cash flow issue. What would your tips be for people to kind of manage that?
Initially is the mindset and the expectation of understanding that it is what it is initially. having some strategies in place to help accommodate for that. So we decided to change our strategy a little bit and introduce a model that would allow us to see some money up front as well. So we would charge for our services and our time like any professional would, whereas beforehand we didn't used to. And after you've built up, some clientele, you got to understand that you just got to have a 6-month buffer, because anything can turn around in 6 months, or anything can be turned around in a short period of time if you give it your effort and your energy and the effort that it deserves. So my top three strategies would be: one is get the expectation right and don't put an unrealistic expectation on yourself. So give yourself some breathing space. Two would be to accommodate for, 6 months worth of expenses. So at any given time, I want to know that my next 6 months worth of bills and expenses and everything was going to be covered, because I know that in 6 months' time, the results I'll be producing then is dependent on what I do today. And third step is go out there and make it happen. Like, don't be lazy about it, and, work your butt off if you need to in the early days, because that's what it takes. You can sit there and complain about why it takes a long time to get paid or whatever it is, or you can just go out and do something about it. And I decided to choose the latter.
So for context, at what point is the business now? How many clients have you had? How many staff do you have now?
Yeah, so we're now about 2.5 years into it. So we've probably got over 150, somewhere between 150 to 200 clients at the moment. We have 80 clients on the go at any given time right now. Staff-wise, we're probably sitting around 10 staff. We did go up and down with some staffing over the years, but I've had to learn some major lessons through that in its own way.
What were some of those lessons?
Look, people are your most they're your most unpredictable resource. Mm. So you don't know what's going to happen. one day everything could be, all nice and rosy and smooth, and the next day, hell could be breaking loose.
I find that with Jess, who's in our office now, actually. She's pretty unpredictable. That's yep.
All right. But you got to work with it, It is what it is. And you've got to have the expectation that you just don't know what to expect. So every day I just have this expectation that, anything could happen. And when it does, I take a step back, let it sink in, and then I'll make a decision, or then I come up with a conclusion, or then I come up with, a train of thought, so to speak. Whereas before, I used to get carried away straight away, and I'd quickly fire back, or I'd quickly, react, as opposed to now I probably respond.
I guess to reflect on the whole journey, mm-hmm. this point, right back to the lolly vending machine days, yep. what have been kind of the common threads and I guess the values that you've developed then and now probably hold on to?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the biggest lessons that I've learned in business from lolly days to now is that the value that you create is what you will be rewarded for in direct proportion type of thing. So the rewards that you reap in life are in direct proportion to the risks that you take and the value that you produce. So back when I first started the lolling machine business, the value I was producing was I was giving, people pleasure and joy by being able to get some sugar, at any time of the day. And that came at a certain value, and I was rewarded for that in direct proportion to that. Whereas now I'm, changing people's lives by setting them on a path that could change their family's generational wealth type of thing. So I'm getting rewarded in direct proportion to that as well. So I think the rewards that you reap are going to be in direct proportions to the value that you produce in life.
And obviously you've learned a lot about building wealth and money management and all of that sort of stuff. Is that how the interest in Yellow Brick Road came about? And perhaps tell us how that became part of this story as well, how it kind of weaved in here.
Absolutely. So Yellow Brick Road was actually a funny story because whilst I was setting up Silvertel and I was still in the seed stage at the time, I was part of a business education group where I was exposed to some really cool people and, you know, some high profile business people around the country. And through through my education, I met Andrew Morello, who was the winner of the first Australian Apprentice, and he was the apprentice for Mark Boris at the time. So Mark Boris was originally, he had Wizard Home Loans, he'd built that up and then sold off to Commonwealth Bank and then went and started Yellow Brick Road. And Yellow Brick Road was, or is a company that's kind of taking on the big four banks by trying to create a different space in the market. So they're all about, you know, helping the mums and dads retire comfortably and build wealth for themselves. So they do the, you know, the finance side of it, but we're also a wealth management business. And it was very complementing to what Silvertel was trying to achieve as well. So at the time, I knew that there was really good synergy there and I wanted to, you know, open that door initially, just even as a, just as a relationship to start with. And then whilst I was talking with Morello, I was just joking around with him. I said, why don't you bring Yellow Brick Road into Adelaide? Because I think there'd be, you know, it'd be a pretty cool market to have in there. He goes, yeah, well, why don't I get you involved? I said, why not? You know, I was doing my finance license at the time, so I was getting my qualifications. And I said to him, yeah, I'm doing my finance ticket. And he goes, all right, done. And we shook hands and, you know, nothing was thought of it. A few weeks later, I get a phone call from him and he said, look, I'm in Adelaide, let's catch up for lunch. So I went down for lunch and all of a sudden he goes, oh, look, these are the contracts, this is the paperwork, this is the sort of deal that we'll do. And he did a deal for me where I wouldn't have to have an upfront investment at the time because he knew my position. This is what's going to be done. So have a read over it and sign off on it and we'll make it happen. And you can have, you know, whatever branch, whatever area you want at the time because there was no Yellow Brick Roads. So I quickly jumped on that. I didn't know the first thing about finance. I didn't know the first thing about wealth management back then. And I decided, no, that's what I wanted to do. So I took on the opportunity, not knowing how I was going to make it work. And before I knew it, I had the first license for South Australia's Yellow Brick Road. And we set up an office on Paynham Road back then in our first office. And still not knowing how I was going to get the business off the ground, I actually came across a friend who wanted to work with me with Silvertel. And I said to him, I said, look, I've got this opportunity. You could come on as a partner and you'd need to get, you know, licensed in this area and we can grow this business together. So he quickly jumped on board and took on the role. And yeah, the rest is kind of, you know, the rest is history sort of thing.
Seems like you've developed this very well integrated world with people, your businesses work well together, you've got the right professionals around you. Has that been a big thing for you?
Absolutely. Having the right people around you is going to be critical in business. And for me, it was one, I had to get the right people around me, but it was more so I needed the people with the same vision and that were trying to do good as well. Because my belief has always been if you do good, good will come back. If you're just going out there to get into business just to make money, you know, you might do it for a period, but after some point, you're going to get bored or, you know, you're not going to have that same drive. Whereas when you're passionate and you're driven and you've got a big goal that you want to achieve, then no matter what challenges and obstacles you're faced with, you'll always find a way to overcome them and, you know, move on and succeed, sort of thing. So yes, the people element is a huge contributing factor in what I was trying to achieve. And I knew that in order to build lasting relationships and lasting businesses where people would be invested in and they'd put their heart and soul into it, I wanted them to be partners with me as opposed to just be employees or just be, you know, working for the business. Because, you know, I believe if someone is invested into the venture, they're going to give it their all. If they're just working there, when things get tough, because they do, it's going to be very easy to start looking elsewhere. So for me, I'm not a believer of, you know, making 100% of something. I'd rather have, you know, 50% of something big as opposed to 100% of something small. And that was a philosophy behind it.
Common thread of yours from day one has been making money while you sleep.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, do you think that we're educated well enough in that, in terms of our focus on wealth? We still seem to be very reliant on things like super.
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts?
Look, I've got a big problem with the education system and what they're doing for people and the type of education they're providing at schools, at universities, because I finished, you know, school and university and still didn't know about taxes, about budgeting, about, you know, investing, about retirement, wealth creation. All these things I had to learn on my own accord after I had, you know, spent tens of thousands of dollars on formal education. Too many people, again, are conditioned to follow a certain system, which is go to school, get a degree, go get a safe, secure job. And, you know, over the last 40 years or so, it's been, you know, put money in your super and at some point, you know, you're either going to have the super or the pension will look after you in the later years. That was all well and good when these things were first introduced. So to give you some numbers, back in the 40s when they first introduced the pension, there was roughly 15 people working to support one pensioner. So 15 taxpayers for one pensioner. Now in 2017, we have roughly about 2.5 taxpayers supporting one pensioner. But by the time all the baby boomers move into retirement, we'll be lucky to have one taxpayer supporting one pensioner, because the baby boomers made up the, you know, biggest number of people born, and they're the ones that are, you know, heavily relying on this pension.
The system's not going to stack up.
No. So the government's already started to encourage people to start looking at ways to fund their own retirement. Then we look at superannuation. Now, same thing. Superannuation is basically you put your money into a pool where it all gets invested by someone who will share the upside with you, but they won't share the downside with you. And we all saw what happened after the GFC, where some, you know, people lost millions of dollars in their supers. You know, some people were wiped out, and it made a massive, massive dent in what life was going to look like for them. So now their plans and everything has changed. So for me, one, I had the problem that, okay, people didn't know what they didn't know about finance and wealth and all this sort of stuff. And two, that the system that we're conditioned to follow doesn't work. It's ineffective and it's a ticking time bomb. And our generation is going to be affected mostly by it, because what's happening right now is that those who can't get onto the property ladder, particularly your first home buyers and the people who want to buy properties and start building a portfolio for themselves, it's the barrier for entry is so high that a lot of people can't get onto that property in the first place. So they're forced to continue renting and continue, you know, going about it in one way. And by doing that, they're not acquiring assets, because that's going to grow in value. So you've got, and obviously the cost of living's increased. We've got so many more expenses than what they had, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So those who don't get on the property ladder are obviously going to start going downhill in time. And those who can get on the property ladder are the ones that are going to maximize on the benefits of that vehicle. So what will happen, and what I believe will happen over time, is that the rich will continue getting richer, but the poor will start to get poorer, and that gap between rich and poor will widen, and there'll be less middle class in time. So to do something about this, obviously we're very big on the education piece, where we have to, you know, where we educate our clients initially on what the situation looks like and what they've got to do about it as well. So we work with a lot of young investors, so Gen Ys and millennials, and teaching them that, look, this is what you got to do. And sometimes if you can't get on the property ladder because you can't afford to buy that house in Norwood or that house around, you know, your parents' house, or spend $500,000-$700,000, well, what other strategy can you employ that'll allow you to invest in properties that are affordable that you can utilize in future
That's what I was going to ask is, you know, a lot of people would say, I completely get what you're saying about pension, I get what you're saying about super, but I can't afford to jump into property. But you're saying there's kind of, maybe we are kind of, yeah, thinking that, yeah, we do have to get this place in Norwood or the rich kind of eastern suburbs.
Absolutely. Sometimes I think we're limited to our own backyard, or, you know, where we live. And the prime example is if you're in Sydney at the moment, if you're a 30-something year old in Sydney, you're just starting out in your career, you've just started to make money, you're living, let's say, and working in the city, it's almost virtually impossible for you to buy a property in Sydney at the moment, because the median price has hit over $1 million. And, you know, just to save up a deposit, it's going to be at least, you know, $150,000 to $200,000. So I don't know anyone that can do that, you know, on average salaries that we've got these days. So there's been a new breed of investors called rentvestors. So these are people that are renting where they want to live, but investing in properties that they can afford to invest in. So, and I'm talking about cheaper properties, you know, properties sub 300,000, sub 400,000, or whatever is affordable for them. What it does is it allows them to get onto the property ladder, to acquire an asset that's going to help them build equity and that's going to increase in value over time. It's also going to help them, depending on the type of property, help them, you know, save some money on their tax position every year. And if they're, you know, if they've picked the right property and if they've done it properly enough, the rent or the income that comes from those kind of properties are big enough to cover their holding costs and, you know, can sustain themselves. So it doesn't require an investment from the investor, you know, on a monthly basis. So as a result of what's happening with these rent investors, it's actually creating a whole new market of people who want to invest in more affordable cities like Adelaide. So we're finding a big shift of people in Sydney and Melbourne. They can't afford to be investing in their own state. So they're looking at other states like Queensland and South Australia and other parts of Australia which are more affordable, which have the same, you know, long-term potential as any other property, so to speak. So by addressing that one little concern, you know, that's opened up a whole new opportunities for that part of the market. Then you've got other, you know, other parts of the market, like the mums and dads who are in the 50s, say late 40s, early 50s, they're thinking about retirement. They don't have enough in their super. They know that they can't rely on the pension. So they're thinking, okay, what do we do about setting ourselves up so that way when we do retire, we don't have to rely on the kids. We don't have to rely on the government. You know, we don't have to sell the house. We don't have to do all that. So these are the people that we help on a daily basis. And it always starts with, where are you right now? Where do you want to be? So what's the ideal outcome? And let's reverse engineer it. What do we need to do and what steps do we need to take in order to help us get there?
Well, Nadal, I think that's a really good way to finish. Thanks for coming in and sharing your fascinating story and all of the insights and lessons learned that have come with it.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio. Find out more about Nadal Rashid at silvertail.com.au. If you're enjoying Rooster Radio, remember to subscribe and review on iTunes. Sign up to our mailing list and listen to more episodes at roosterradio.biz. And finally, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/roosterradiohq.